Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a poetry reading in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the Three Penny Review, one of the country's most revered literary magazines. Tonight's reading is co-sponsored by the Boston University Creative Writing Program and features five distinguished poets: Frank Bidart, David Ferry, Louise Gluck, Jill McDonough, and Robert Pinsky. We begin with an introduction by Three Penny Review founding editor, Wendy Lesser.
One of the enormous pleasures of editing the Three Penny Review for me has been meeting poets and reading poetry and learning more about the world of poetry, that is, the ones that I like. I'm sure there are all sorts of poets out there that I don't know that might not be as great as the ones I do, but the ones that I know, I am really fond of in a way that I think partakes of the fact that I'm not a poet, and so I think that what they do is magic. I don't understand really how they can do it, and that's particularly true of the five who are reading for us tonight. And they all have a very strong connection with the Three Penny Review. I just am lucky that in Boston we have this concentration of some of our best poets, and they all were willing to read tonight very, very generously, and it makes the Three Penny Review and me feel honored to have them connected with it. So I'm going to introduce them all at once, and then you'll have to see them come up separately, but you probably know who they all are already anyway, so it doesn't really matter what I say about them, but I will say a little something about them. They'll read for you in alphabetical order, so I will mention them in alphabetical order. First will be Frank Bidart, who I know this is not a big part of his poetry biography, but I always start by saying he's a native Californian, as I am, and as Three Penny Review is. Hails from Bakersfield originally, but has been a part of the Boston area poetry scene for many years, although I know Frank because he was in Berkeley for a while, was a guest there, drawn by a special poetry fellowship, and he became a very important and vital part of the poetry scene in Berkeley for the short time he was there. And Frank, as some of you may know, is the I've only written down the titles because I don't want to get anyone's wrong, is the author of books like Stardust, Music Like Dirt, and Watching the Spring Festival, and a number of others, but those three are out there and can be signed afterwards, along with books by all four other poets as well. So afterwards you'll have a chance to get their books signed and speak to them individually. He's also the editor of Robert Lowell's Collected Poems, and he is a consulting editor to the Three Penny Review, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. The person makes of it what they will, but in Frank's sense, what it means is that he sends me his poetry and, you know, has a very solid connection with the magazine and has, in fact, been appearing in it since 1985. David Ferry has been appearing in Three Penny Review since 1994, and he is both a wonderful poet in his own right. The book that I think they have out there of his is Of No Country I Know. But he's also a translator of such a high order that his own poetry and the translation merge into each other. That is, no other translator of those works could do them as well as David does because of the feeling he has for the poetry and the feeling he has for the English language. So his Gilgamesh and his translations of Horace and Virgil, I think the Virgil one is out there and the Gilgamesh is out there, are an interesting combination of the author, the original author themselves, and David's sensibility for English poetry. And the next one up is Louise Gluck, who is also a Three Penny consulting editor and has been giving me many, many of what I think are her best poems, particularly these wonderful poems in the latest book, A Village Life, which is a book that's almost like a novel or a short story or a travelogue of a country that sort of exists but doesn't really exist and has these individual characters who have lives that come across to us in the poems. And before that were wonderful other books like Averno and Vita Nova and Ararat, all the way back to the beginning. She just started writing at a very high level and continued, you know, at the most amazing level from then on. And Louise has been writing for Three Penny since 1984, and I think has had 20 items in the magazine. That includes prose. She hardly ever writes prose, but sometimes I squeeze it out of her, and it's really good prose. And there's a book of it, too, actually, Proofs and Theorems. Next up, alphabetically, will be Jill McDonough, who's the baby of the crowd in our terms. She's only been writing for the magazine since 2004, but in that time already has had 7 poems in the magazine. And if you know, it only comes out 4 times a year, so that's frequent. And in fact, it might have been Christopher Ricks, who's out there in the audience, who first got Jill to send work to me, but it could also have been Robert Pinsky. She was here in the BU writing program, and she was writing a book which has now come out in book form called Habeas Corpus. But long before it was a book, it was a series of separate sonnets about executions in American history. And so she sent me these, and I took them pretty much, you know, off the top of my head without knowing anything about her, just because they were such stunning poems. And then subsequently met her because we were both fellows at the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers in New York, and since then she's been a Stegner Fellow. So Jill is still in some ways at the beginning of her career, and yet it's already a very serious and substantial career. And last but never least is Robert Pinsky, who, first of all, who helped me through Maggie Dietz and on his own organize this. He lugged all those heavy three-penny reviews that are out there on the desk for you to look up afterwards that are out with the poet's books. And Robert has been writing for Three Penny longer even than any of these others. I think he started in 1983. He lived in Berkeley for a while, and I got to know him quite well during that period, and he and Ellen were sort of a center of literary social life. They gave the 4th of July party where Czeslaw Milosz would run into, you know, I was going to say Bob Hass, but he would run into him in other places, but he would run into me or my 3-year-old son who would sing to him or whatever. You know, I mean, it was a great party that they gave, and they were a really vital part of Berkeley life. Robert, as you know, has been the Poet Laureate 3 times, has published wonderful books, including Gulf Music, The Figured Wheel, and The Want Bone. And recently, for this reading, I was looking up the number of times he had published in Three Penny, and I think it was 29, which is really verging on the top number that anybody has ever published in Three Penny. Some of that is prose, terrific prose, which not all of which has appeared in book form. Some of it's still only in Three Penny, and some of it is poetry. Really, I would say, among my favorite poems of his, speaking of favorite poems, are the ones he has published in Three Penny. So they're all deeply connected with the magazine. They're all in some way connected with BU or the larger Boston community, and I'm grateful to them for reading for Three Penny tonight.
I'm going to read 5 poems, 2 of which are very short. The first is a very old poem. The rest are new. Guilty of dust. Up or down from the infinite center, brimming at the winking rim of time, the voice in my head said, love is the distance between you and what you love. What you love is your fate. Then I saw the parade of my loves, those performers, comics, actors, singers, forgetful of my very self, so often I desired to die to myself, to live in them. Then my parents, my friends, the drained specters once filled with my baffled infatuations, love and guilt and fury and sweetness for whom nail spirit yearning to the earth. Then the voice in my head said, whether you love what you love or live in divided, ceaseless revolt against it, what you love is your fate. those nights. Those nights when, despite his exhaustion or indifference, you persisted. Then finally, it caught, so that at last he too wanted it. Suddenly was desperate to reach it. You felt his muscles want it more than anything. As if through this chaos, this wilderness, he again knew the one thing he must reach. Though later, after he found it, his resentment implied he had been forced. Those nights ended because what was missing could never be, by the will, supplied. We who could get somewhere through words, through sex, could not. I was, you said, your shrink. That's how I held you. I failed as my own. Now you surely are dead. I've searched the databases. You everywhere elude us. Long ago, without your reaching to tell me, surely the plague killed you. Each thing in your life you found so incommensurate to the spirit. I imagine that becoming untraceable makes you smile. Name the bed. Scream stretched across it. Someone wanted more from that bed than was found there. Name the bed that's not true of. Bed where your twin died. Eraser bed. For an unwritten opera. Once you had a secret love, seeing even his photo, a window is flung open high in the airless edifice that is you. Though everything looks as if it is continuing just as before, it is not. It is continuing in a new way. Sweet lingo O'Hara and Ashbury teach. That's not how you naturally speak. You tell yourself first that he is not the air you need. Second, that you loathe air. As a boy, you despise the world for replacing God with another addiction, love. Despised yourself. Was there no third thing? But every blue moon, the skeptical, the adamantly disabused, find themselves, like you, returned to life by a secret, like him in you. Now you understand Janáček at 70. In love with a much younger married woman, chastely writing her. As in Mozart, song remains, no matter how ordinary, how flawed the personae. For us poor mortals, private accommodations, magpie beauty. And lastly, a very short poem called Poem Ending with a Sentence by Heath Ledger. It's made up of two sentences. I wrote the first one. The first describes Ledger's two most famous roles, the Joker and then Ennis Del Mar in Brokeback Mountain. poem ending with a sentence by Heath Ledger. Each grinding, flattened American vowel, smashed to centerlessness. His glee that whatever mutilated the boy long ago, he has mastered to mutilate you. The Joker's voice. So unlike the bruised, withheld, wounded voice of Ennis Delmar. Once I have the voice, that's the line. And at the end of the line is a hook, and attached to that is the soul. Thanks.
First one is called Willoughby Spit. The little fence around the tiny front yard seemed very little, even to a child. Even as a child, visiting there from the north for a week or maybe 2 weeks every summer, I experienced the place as if I had been reading in a book that was written for very young children to read. Vivid, crude, charming, frightening in the way it simplified some truth about the world you didn't know enough to know about. There were a few flowers in the little front yard, ineptly shaped by nature, looking as if someone in a hurry had stuck them in the sand. There were some boards for getting across the sand from the gate to the front porch steps. The boards were burning under your feet with an intensity that took your breath away. It was so hot, you could smell the heat of the old gray boards of the little walk and the fence as if they might burst into smokeless flame at any moment. The sand of the beach across the street was dark. It was a surprise to step on it and find that it was burning dry, although in fact the flat, dull waters of the bay had been known to rise up in rage and smite the shore and get all the way to the road that divided the spit, and even across it, and even across the sand on the other side of the road, almost to reach the smaller bay beyond. The other houses were mostly those of strangers, though of course not all of them were strangers to Aunt Nellie, but hardly any were friends, since she was bound within the spell her eccentricity drew like a magic circle around her in the sand, so none might enter. In the sands, behind the houses, there were scrub pines, and living in the woodshed behind Aunt Nellie's house were black widow spiders, so I was told. In the little dark parlor of the house, there was an upright piano, table lamps with lampshades with beads along their lower edges. There was a rocker made of some very dark wood, varnished almost black. A couple of other armchairs, high-backed, perhaps of the same wood, but with needlepoint-covered seats, and one of them with needlepoint oval insets on the arms. On a table, a newspaper called, I think, The Pilot, telling perhaps the story of how a drunken sailor on the roller coaster that used to tower high above the other attractions at Ocean View Amusement Park nearby, like the skeleton of a dinosaur, had stood up just as the car tipped over the highest point of the highest loop, and how he fell straight down to his death while the car plunged down on its thrilling tracks, entirely unconcerned. Or else it was from a Ferris wheel that he fell, just as the wheel had brought him to the top. And when he stood up, The footboard under his feet seemed to rock back and forward and back and forward, then poured him out over and down, a little figure vividly clear as he fell in the story I heard of a roller coaster or Ferris wheel back then. How long ago the sailor must have forgotten the manner of his death. On the piano were some pages of sheet music. In the gloaming, oh my darling, when the lights are burning low and the shadows of the evening softly come and softly go. In the summer heat, the door in from the front porch was always a little bit open, but the light from outside got only a little way in. On another table, a candy dish or ashtray, decorated with a woman's head with marceled golden hair and a Grecian profile, expressing some noble outrage or otherwise disturbed emotion, for example, catastrophic loss. There was a curtain, beaded also, I think, between the living room and the dining room that loomed in littleness beyond. There was a huge dining room table and a huge sideboard, the two of them so big you'd have thought the room had to be built around them to get them in, inherited long ago from a larger house or a wedding present with larger expectations. And next to this was the dark bedroom in which Aunt Nellie and her husband, Uncle Frank, slept together in sexless affection, as if in secret collusion. On the bedroom dresser, there was a hairnet, a box containing pins, straight pins and safety, mixed in with jewelry, brooches and earrings, bracelets and other such things. They glinted in the darkness of the room. In the sand, out back of the house, there were those little black or dark purple pods or pod-like things, some kind of seaweed, which on the beach up north in New Jersey, I like to pick up and burst between my fingers. But here, because of the spiders, they reminded me of them, and I didn't touch them. Aunt Nellie's picture was in the paper once, triumphantly posing with a large bottle. Black widow spiders inside looking out, as conscious as fireflies of their situation. And the last poem is a translation, one of the most famous of Horace's odes, Ode 214, to Posthumus. How the years go by. Alas, how the years go by. Behaving well can do nothing at all about it. Wrinkles will come. Old age will come. And death, indomitable. Nothing at all will work. Offer in pledge 300 oxen a day. Unweeping Pluto will never be appeased. Giants he holds in thrall down there forever. On the other bank of that dark stream that all who eat and drink the good things of the earth must cross at last, whoever they may be, rich man or poor man, whatever, it doesn't matter. In vain that you fear what's born on the sick south wind. In vain that you survived the bloody field. In vain that you made for port, having ridden out the terrible storm that time on the Adriatic, it doesn't matter at all. However it happens, each one of us shall come to see the black river Cocytus wandering through the region where Danaus' wicked daughters endlessly suffer and Sisyphus forever labors on. Each one of us must leave the earth he loves, and leave his home, and leave his tender wife, and leave the trees he planted and took good care of. Only the cypress grows along those banks. Your heir will drink the choice Caecuban wine you did not know that you were saving for him when you locked it up securely in your cellar. The wine he spills is priceless. It doesn't matter.
These are all from A Village Life, much of which indeed appeared in Threepenny. Tributaries. All the roads in the village unite at the fountain, Avenue of Liberty, Avenue of the Acacia Trees. The fountain rises at the center of the plaza on sunny days, rainbows in the piss of the cherub. In summer, couples sit at the pool's edge. There's room in the pool for many reflections. The plaza is nearly empty. The acacia trees don't get this far. And the Avenue of Liberty is barren and austere. Its image doesn't crowd the water. Interspersed with the couples, mothers with their younger children. Here's where they come to talk to one another, maybe meet a young man, see if there's anything left of their beauty. When they look down, it's a sad moment. The water isn't encouraging. The husbands are off working. But by some miracle, all the amorous young men are always free. They sit at the edge of the fountain, splashing their sweethearts with fountain water. Around the fountain, there are clusters of metal tables. This is where you sit when you're old, beyond the intensities of the fountain. The fountain is for the young who still want to look at themselves, or for the mothers who need to keep their children diverted. In good weather, a few old people linger at the tables. Life is simple now. One day cognac, one day coffee and a cigarette. To the couples, it's clear who's on the outskirts of life, who's at the center. The children cry, they sometimes fight over toys. But the water's there to remind the mothers that they love these children, that for them to drown would be terrible. The mothers are tired constantly. The children are always fighting. The husbands at work or angry. No young man comes. The couples are like an image from some faraway time, an echo coming very faint from the mountains. They're alone at the fountain in a dark well. They've been exiled by the world of hope, which is the world of action, but the world of thought hasn't as yet opened to them. When it does, everything will change. Darkness is falling, the plaza empties. The first leaves of autumn litter the fountain. The roads don't gather here anymore. The fountain sends them away, back into the hills they came from. Avenue of broken faith, avenue of disappointment, avenue of the acacia trees, of olive trees, the wind filling with silver leaves. Avenue of lost time, avenue of liberty that ends in stone, not at the field's edge, but at the foot of the mountain. A Village Life. The death and uncertainty that await me as they await all men. The shadows evaluating me because it can take time to destroy a human being. The element of suspense needs to be preserved. On Sundays, I walk my neighbor's dog so she can go to church to pray for her sick mother. The dog waits for me in the doorway. Summer and winter, we walk the same road early morning at the base of the escarpment. Sometimes the dog gets away from me. For a moment or two, I can't see him behind some trees. He's very proud of this. This trick he brings out occasionally and gives up again as a favor to me. Afterward, I go back to my house to gather firewood. I keep in my mind images from each walk. Monarda growing by the roadside. In early spring, the dog chasing the little gray mice. So for a while, it seems possible not to think of the hold of the body weakening, the ratio of the body to the void shifting, and the prayers becoming prayers for the dead. Midday, the church bells finished. Light in excess. Still, fog blankets the meadow so you can't see the mountain in the distance, covered with snow and ice. When it appears again, my neighbor thinks her prayers are answered. So much light she can't control her happiness. It has to burst out in language. Hello, she yells, as though that is her best translation. She believes in the Virgin the way I believe in the mountain, though in one case the fog never lifts. But each person stores his hope in a different place. I make my soup. I pour my glass of wine. I'm tense like a child approaching adolescence. Soon it will be decided for certain what you are, one thing, a boy or girl, not both any longer. And the child thinks, I want to have a say in what happens. But the child has no say whatsoever. When I was a child, I did not foresee this. Later, the sun sets, the shadows gather, rustling the low bushes like animals just awake for the night. Inside, there's only firelight. It fades slowly. Now, only the heaviest woods still flickering across the shelves of instruments. I hear music coming from them sometimes, even locked in their cases. When I was a bird, I believed I would be a man. That's the flute. And the horn answers, when I was a man, I cried out to be a bird. Then the music vanishes. And the secret it confides in me vanishes also. In the window, the moon is hanging over the earth, meaningless but full of messages. It's dead. It's always been dead. But it pretends to be something else, burning like a star and convincingly, so that you feel sometimes it could actually make something grow on earth. If there's an image of the soul, I think that's what it is. I move through the dark as though it were natural to me, as though I were already a factor in it. Tranquil and still, the day dawns. On market day, I go to the market with my lettuces.
I'm Jill McDonough.
I'm going to read some poems that appeared in Threepenny and then one new one. Amos D. Squire, Chief Physician of Sing Sing, 1914 to 1925. Dr. Squire witnessed 138 executions before he quit. He'd watch their breathing, signal on the exhale, watch a man, hooded, strain against straps. Then guards opened a shirt, swabbed sweat, so Squire could listen with his stethoscope. Many times I have been so overwrought, I was alarmed by the thought that what I heard was my own pulse rather than that of the dying man. One day in 1925, he stood at the edge of the rubber mat, just within reach of the chair. He gave the signal, and the man was electrocuted as usual, except I felt for the first time a wild desire to extend my hand and touch him. I'm going to read three of the sonnets about executions that appeared in Threepenny. The first one is July 12th, 1726, William Fly, Boston, Massachusetts. A boatswain on an English slaver, he threw his masters overboard, was caught within the week. In prison, he refused all food and drink except for rum. Refused to forgive his enemies or say he had. No, I won't die with a lie in my mouth. He swore all the way to the scaffold, wished the ship would fly away with devils, cursed himself, the day he was born, and her that bare him, heaven, the God who judged him, the man who turned him in. They prayed for his repentance. He offered scorn, then awed the crowd with advice to the hangman on his trade. He tied the knot himself. They let him sway, then tarred his body and gibbeted him in the bay. May 3rd, 1946, Willie Francis, St. Martinsville, Louisiana. They brought Louisiana's only chair in a pickup from Angola into St. Martinsville Parish, to the courthouse, where a 15-year-old colored boy had lain on straw for months. Jailhouse on the second floor. Death kindly took the elevator. Wires were tossed from dynamo to window. Four men setting up the chair passed flasks, dead tired, and innocent of amps. They called the priest and pulled the switch and thought he'd die. He shook and lurched and gasped, "You're not supposed to breathe." They shut it down, freed him from straps and hood. Then Willie Francis stood up without help and, miracle, miracle, walked back to his cell. May 9th, 1947, Willie Francis, St. Martinsville, Louisiana. The Times reporters asked him to describe the taste of death. Cold peanut butter, fair stars, little speckles, pink and green, like shines in a rooster's tail. He said, "God fooled with the chair." His father smashed his gravestone into slivers of granite. Hundreds wrote, "Divine intervention," how gold electrodes would corrode and silver wires short if they tried to kill that boy again. Like Daniel in the lion's den, those men in Nebuchadnezzar's furnace, unusual, cruel, double jeopardy, none of that could save him. At noon, the chair was ready, voltage full. He said, "Everything is all right," and died without pink stars, green, anything divine. coffee for everyone. The cup exotic in your same old hands, so warm, almost normal after the night you had. Holding a paper cup to your mouth, your poor bleared eyes, your forehead, is American, our gesture. What have you done? An empty table, a paper cup of coffee. A small room filled with the knowledge of good, of freshly ground. Wake up. In America, we have plenty. There's coffee for everyone, even for you. According to the Washington Post, he was enticed with Starbucks coffee. Food when you asked for it, all the coffee you could drink. We are American enough to think right off of the ad we could make for Starbucks. Quick cinematic cuts of a desert, a middle of the night rendition. Our brave soldiers in green night vision go, 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 surprising you in your spider hole. Then the flight, hooded you in a cavernous cargo hold, circled by special ops, enormous guns. Cut back to you dragged off the plane and past the barking dogs. Split seconds of razor wire, bars, interrogation rooms. Gradual rise of quiet, the calm of a fate accomplied. Then birdsong, the smell, not smell, aroma of good hot American coffee, just $9.95 a pound. Your fat, hairy hands cuffed to the table, wrapped around the familiar paper cup, close up, benevolent goddess, ring of night vision green. A hush falls, hush at the pivot of a nation, the center of a century's legal thoughts near undoing. And you weep, strain to hold the cup to your sorry face. Tell us everything we want to know. Thank you.
I'll read 10 minutes worth of poems that I published in the Three Penny Review. This may or may not be the first poem I ever published in the Three Penny Review. I know it was when I was in California and Wendy was a graduate student, and I was about 37. And I remember that I was a Californian at the time and that I wrote the poem in the East in the summer back, and it's partly out of nostalgia for East Coast beaches. It became the title poem of my book, The Want Bone. The Want Bone. The tongue of the waves tolled in the earth's bell. Blue rippled and soaked in the fire of blue. The dried mouth bones of a shark in the hot swale gaped on nothing but sand on either side. The bone tasted of nothing and smelled of nothing, a scalded, toothless harp, uncrushed, unstrung. The joined arcs made the shape of birth and craving, and the welded open shape kept mouthing, oh. Ossified cords held the corners together in groined spirals, pleated like a summer dress. But where was the limber grin, the gash of pleasure? Infinitesimal mouths bore it away, the beach scrubbed and etched and pickled it clean. But oh, I love you, it sings, my little, my country, my food, my parent, my child. I want you, my own, my thin, my flower, my life, my lightness, my O. I'll read a poem from sort of, I think of as middle, me and the Three Penny Review. This is Ode to Meaning. Dire one and desired one. Savior, sentencer. In an old allegory, you would carry a chained alphabet of tokens. Unk, badge, cross, dragon. Engraved figure guarding hallowed intaglio. Jasper kinema of legendary mind. Naked omphalos pierced by quills of rhyme or sense Torah-like. Unborn vein of will. Xenophile yearning out of zero. Untrusting, I court you. Wavering, I seek your face. I read that Crusoe's knife reeked of you. That to defile you, the soldier makes the rabbi spit on the Torah. I'll drown my book, says Shakespeare. Drowned Walker, Revenant. After my mother fell on her head, she became more than ever your sworn enemy. She spoke sometimes like a poet or critic of 50 years later. Or she spoke of the world as Thersites speaks of the heroes. Quote, I think they have swallowed one another. I would laugh at that miracle. End quote. You also in the laughter, you warrior angel, your helmet the zodiac, rocket-plumed, your spear the beggar's finger pointing to the mouth, your heel planted on the serpent, formulation, your face a vapor, the wreath of cigarette smoke crowning Bogart as he winces through it. You, not in the words, not even between the words, but a torsion, a cleavage, a stirring. You stirring even in the Arctic ice, even at the dark ocean floor, even in the cellular flesh of a stone, gas, gossamer. My poker friends question your presence in a poem by me. Passing the magazine one to another, like apes with an oyster. Not the stone and not the words, you like a veil over my friend Arthur's headstone, the passage from Proverbs Arthur chose while he was too ill to teach, but still well enough to read. I was beside the master craftsman, delighting him every day, day after day, ever at play in his presence. You, a soothing veil of distraction, playing over dying Arthur, playing in the hospital, thumbing his Bible, fuzzy from medication, ever courting your presence. And you, the prognosis, you in the cough. Gesturer, when is your spur, your cloud? You in the airport rituals of greeting and parting. Inditer, who is your claimant? Bell at the gate, spiderweb iron bridge, cloak, video, aroma, rue. What is your elected silence? Where was your seed? What is imagination but your lost child, born to give birth to you? Dire one, desired one, savior, sentence, absence, or presence ever at play. Let those scorn you who never starved in your dearth. If I dare to disparage your harp of shadows, I taste wormwood and motor oil. I pour ashes on my head. You are the wound. You be the medicine. and close and close this wonderful reading. This is the poem I published in the last Three Penny Review but one. It's a kind of a translation, a loose translation of a poem by the Hebrew poet Chaim Bialik. And it's Bialik in a rather aggressive way talking about his writing and his poetry in relation to us readers. Chaim Bialik's Light, after the Hebrew. I didn't win light by some stroke of luck. It wasn't left me in my father's will. I carved my light from living rock. I quarried it out of my heart. Deep in that rock, a spark is hidden, not large, not much, but mine. Not rented, not borrowed, not bought, not stolen, light entirely my own. Sorrow hammers its mighty blows, and the rock endures until it cracks with a bright flash that blinds my eyes, light that I seal into verse. When you breathe lines I made, they kindle a flame, vanishing bright. With my own marrow and my heart's blood, I pay the price for that light.
So, if I were Mark Morris, I would have rehearsed the dancers in their curtain call, and I'm not Mark Morris, and I didn't, but could the five of you get up and face your fans and take a bow?
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a poetry reading in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the literary magazine, The Three Penny Review. Tonight's reading was co-sponsored by the Boston University Creative Writing Program and featured poets Frank Bidart, David Ferry, Louise Gluck, Jill McDonough, and Robert Pinsky. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda with help from Alden Fertig. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.